Support for the World's Podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
La China versus El Gringo today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Peruvians head to the polls this weekend. They're choosing between Alberto Fujimori's daughter, known as La China, and El Gringo, a man considered so Americanized, he's wooing voters by adopting Peru's favorite animal as a mascot.
The guinea pig is a really big part of Peruvian culture. You find guinea pig imagery all over souvenir shops all throughout Peru. Guinea pigs are eaten as a delicacy throughout the country, and they're just like a very beloved animal.
Speaking of beloved animals, let's talk about Canada's beavers and the castoreum they provide.
It's from a gland, the castor gland, which is in the nether regions of the beaver. It's used in perfume mostly.
Castor gland number 5. Those stories are coming up here on The World. As we race to the end of the school year, today we'll introduce you to two incredible students, one about to graduate from high school and the other an undocumented immigrant who just graduated with her PhD. We're going to start off, though, with a wrap-up from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. All this week, a military court has been holding pre-trial hearings for the 5 men accused in the September 11th attacks. Some of the testimony includes allegations from detainees of mental torture. My colleague here at WGBH, Arun Roth, is in Guantanamo, where he's been covering the hearings, and he says a lot of the testimony deals with a top-secret site within the base called Camp 7.
Camp 7 is a very secretive, clandestine place. No one gets in there for tours, and it's where the highest-value detainees are kept. They don't even let people know exactly where it is on the base. One of the defendants in the case, Ramzi bin al-Shib, has claimed he's being subjected to abuse there, harassment by sound and noise reminiscent of his CIA torture. Earlier this year, he testified about what he was experiencing, and this week the defense called other witnesses to testify about what they were experiencing there in the mysterious Camp 7.
Yeah, does bin al-Shib have evidence that the conditions are atrocious?
Well, he doesn't have physical evidence, but what they do have is backup from some of the other inmates. One who was called yesterday, Hassan Galil, he complained of abuses as well. He said that there's mental torture, those are the words that he used, about Camp 7. Sounds, vibrations, he also described smells, and he said every minute, every second, every day, practically. He made it sound pretty bad.
How did the prosecution respond to this?
Very aggressively, I'd say, Marco. Prosecutor Ed Ryan took on Galil with, I'd even say, a hostile cross-examination. So to establish bias, he asked him about outbursts that he'd had with the guards, trying to establish his identity as a jihadist and terrorist. He asked about an incident where Galil spat at a guard through the food tray hole, and Galil was actually not fazed by this. He said, if you were in here, you'd do the same or worse. And he denied everything. He denied being a terrorist, denied being a jihadist, said America was not his enemy. But Ryan just kept at it. And by the end, the prosecutor, Ed Ryan, just said flat out to him, you're lying.
So this is a hearing. How could the conditions in Camp 7 ultimately affect the status of the detainees during their trial?
Well, this would be more material. We talked about this before, which goes towards mitigation. Thinking about the eventual sentence and the ways in which these guys may or may not have been abused can factor into maybe getting them out of the death penalty if it comes to that at the sentencing stage.
When we spoke earlier this week, Arun, you were anxiously waiting for the testimony of one of Gitmo's most notorious prisoners, Abu Zubaydah. He hasn't been seen out of custody since 2002. Did he testify?
No, he didn't. And it was one of these really peculiar situations that happens here with some regularity. After all this buildup, and Zubaydah was getting right to the door of the courtroom, we couldn't actually see him, but we got the report later on. At the last minute, they decided not to call him. What happened was Zubaydah's own lawyer, this is Navy Commander Patrick Floor, was present to make sure Zubaydah didn't make any self-incriminating statements. But after seeing that cross-examination of Khalid, all the questions about being a jihadist, you know, asking if you're a member of Al-Qaeda, that kind of thing, it was clear that not incriminating himself was going to be very difficult. So they've postponed his testimony until they can work out some way to dance around that, some kind of immunity or some other way to move forward.
Arun, with your finger on the pulse of what happens at Guantanamo Bay, can you see the base closing down before President Obama leaves office?
No. I do not see how that could happen. Just logistically, Marco, you know, we're in June now. Even if all the prisoners cleared for transfer or release, there's still this smaller core group who they don't want to release, including these five men on trial. And the military commissions sure will not be over by then. So, no, I simply just do not see how it's possible that the prison facility here in Guantanamo could be closed by the time the president leaves office.
WGBH's Arun Ross speaking with me from Camp Justice at the U.S. Naval Base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Arun, thank you very much.
Marco, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Our next story is about a young scientist in California doing some groundbreaking medical research. She also put herself through school picking watermelons and cleaning hotels. And one other thing, she recently became one of the few undocumented students in the U.S. to get her Ph.D. Sasha Coca has a story from Merced.
Have you ever seen a beating heart pulsing on its own after it's been taken out of the body?
You can see that it's still beating.
I know, it's wild.
It's a very impressive organ.
Yuriana Aguilar is injecting a special dye into a tiny mouse heart at a lab at the University of California in Merced, in the state's Central Valley. She's researching the electrical signals in the human heart just before sudden cardiac death, which is a major cause of death in the U.S.
So this is a heart that is going to be right now perfused with the dye that goes into the membrane so that we can look at the electrical signaling going on. Some solution here.
She came to California from Michoacán, Mexico, with her farm worker parents when she was five. None of them have immigration papers.
There are fears. I fear, like if I'm in the flea market, if they're doing maybe deportations or something, nobody's going to care that I have a title, maybe.
But Yuriana, who's now 26, is protected from deportation by the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals federal program. It protects those brought to the U.S. as children, although she's still not eligible for many grants and fellowships, like other postdocs.
I wondered how you felt, you know, hearing people say things like, you're taking the space of a U.S. citizen, or why should you have this opportunity, or ICE should come and deport you.
I'm used to hearing those comments. There's shortages of researchers, there's shortages in physicians. Definitely if somebody is more qualified, go for it.
After working at the lab, Yuriana drives with her husband and baby girl to visit her parents on the farm. They grow squash and cucumbers, raise goats. Yuriana's mother, Ana Torres, usually has dirty hands from picking squash. But she recently got a manicure to attend two graduations, Yuriana with her doctorate and a son as a pilot. I ask her and her husband, Arturo, what's their secret? How did two farm workers who didn't finish elementary school put five kids through college? We'd talk to them a lot, tell them they're smart, says Arturo, and we would pay them $20 for every A and B they got. And if they got an F, they had to pay us $25 or $30. We had to work hard to earn more money if they got A's, but it was worth it. And if they didn't do a good job in school, they had to pick 10 boxes of spiny cactus. Ana and Arturo say they were tough on their kids, but loving and involved.
La mejor inversión que pueden hacer es darle estudio a sus hijos.
Arturo has some advice for other immigrant parents. Don't use your paycheck to buy a new car that only stays shiny for a while, he says. It's better to invest in your children's education. That lasts their whole lives.
Ella lo sabe que estamos muy orgullosos y que no tengo palabras ya que.
Ana says she's proud of Yuriana. She starts crying and hugs her daughter.
Antes lloraba especialmente cuando Yuri me hablaba para decirme que.
Her happy tears, she says. Before, she'd cry when people told Yuriana they cared more about her immigration status than her intelligence, her knowledge. Thank you for believing in me, says Yuriana, despite all the obstacles we faced. You always said the government may not give you papers, but no one can take away your education.
Yo siempre les dijimos que esa era la herencia que les íbamos a dar.
It's the only inheritance you'll get from us, Ana tells her.
Tener los dos pies, las dos manos para trabajar, nosotros íbamos a sacarlos adelante y que ellos se sintieran.
And as long as we have feet to stand on and hands to work, we'll support you. Yuriana Aguilar hopes to open her own medical research lab someday. But even then, she says, she won't mind working in the field sometimes or buying some land to farm. She says you have to do every job with dignity and with your heart. For The World, Sasha Coca, Merced, California.
Here's a story now about another student who's done something out of the ordinary. Quite extraordinary, in fact. He's a graduating senior right here in Boston at the oldest public school in America, the Boston Latin School. It's been a tough year at Boston Latin. A student body that is almost four times as white as the Boston Public School average, charges by students of color of racial bias, and charges that the charges were not adequately addressed. In the midst of this tension, this student was focused on something else, creating sketches of all his graduating classmates as a farewell gift. Philip Sosu joins me now. You are really talented. You could easily be one of those guys on the street who just does these fantastic portraits of passersby. So that's cool. Take us back to early last week. You had over 400 really great charcoal portraits, and you get to school early before everyone else. Tell us what you did and why you did it.
The day before, I stayed up around 11 p.m., and I started hanging up the portraits. But I intended to hang up all 411 by then, but the janitors kicked me out at 11. I was still in the process of putting them up when people were coming in. That's how long it took, even with the help of six other people. Mm. When people started coming in, it was like utter surprise. Because I was like telling people, I was like, oh, I need your picture. I'm trying to draw everyone into grade. But you know, I'm not really sure if anyone actually believed I would complete it.
So when classmates of yours started asking you, why'd you do this? And thank you. I mean, what were some of the conversations?
I saw some parents crying. That was pretty touching. Mm. Unexpected as well.
Why do you think they were moved to tears? I mean, they're beautiful portraits, but what prompted that?
I think they thought it was just cool to see, you know, everyone together, you know, to see a positive thing in the school.
I mean, you say the parents, you think, saw this as a positive thing, and this has been a pretty tough year when you think back to the racial tensions at Boston Latin. How did it affect you personally?
You know, I just sort of kept to myself, and I was drawing the portraits the whole time.
Did you think there was a problem? You just didn't want to kind of, like, go there, or?
I feel like the problem was definitely magnified. It's these microaggressions. They're definitely a problem, but it's not, like, outright racism. Like, everyone, like, it's not like that. But,
I mean, some have said it's outright racism.
People have said it's outright racism. I've yet to see it. Maybe they're right. I'm not going to say that they're wrong, but I haven't seen it myself.
Did you ever have in the back of your mind while you were doing these portraits that maybe this project was a way to kind of gentle down the tension and bring people together?
While I was drawing the portraits, I was thinking that maybe this was a waste of time because the kids wouldn't appreciate it because there was so much tension. But I decided to put it up anyway because if I'm going to draw 411 portraits, I might as well display them.
You still think maybe it was a waste of time?
No.
Yeah, I think you would.
Not at all. The reaction is, it's amazing.
You're born in Minnesota, but your parents are from Ghana. Do they have any artistic ability that rubbed off on you?
No. No.
What does this whole project mean to you?
At this point, everyone's telling me, I want to keep the picture. So I'm thinking, this is something that people are going to be able to keep and look back on in 10 years and then remember the day that they came into school and saw all the pictures, you know, side by side. You know, it's a happy memory that people are going to be able to keep.
Well, it is a truly wonderful thing you've done. Philip Sosu, thanks for stopping by today.
It was my pleasure.
After Philip and I spoke today, he gave a drawing lesson to two of our producers here, and they spoke about how race played out in their high schools. But we also want to hear from you. Tell us about one episode where race shaped your high school experience. We asked if Philip would choose one of your stories and sketch the person who tells it. So look for The World on Facebook and tell us your story. You might just end up with your own portrait by Philip Sosu. A presidential election in Peru brings the guinea pigs out of the woodwork later here on The World. Hey, here's some good news if you have ties to one of Florence's richest families. Your money isn't going anywhere. Economists have identified that the richest families in Florence have been on top for the past 600 years. Gianni Riotta is a columnist with La Stampa. He joins me from New York. So who are these families, Gianni, and where did their wealth come from originally?
We can go, you know, these two economists from the Bank of Italy, Guglielmo Barone and Sauro Mocetti, what they did, they linked the census of Florence 1427 with the census of Florence 2011. And they found out that the first top players and the richest people, they're still in the richest family. There are the Grassos family, there are the Bernardos family. And it's difficult now to see who they are today, because for privacy reasons, they didn't give the name today. But if you belong to that family, you may have a different surname now. You're still the richest person in Florence. And that's not very good for, you know, Italian mobility.
Yeah, why not? Explain how that works.
In Italy, the economy protects the insiders. In banking, for lawyers, even doctors, if your father or mother or grandfather were prominent in that positions, they will be passing on the clouds to their heirs.
Do you think that accounts to a large degree why this money has remained parked for, what, 600 years now?
Yeah, but also you see, if you look at the most of the Italian companies are family owned. Very often the founding father appoints the firstborn son, now the firstborn daughter, as the CEO. The Italian capitalism is still pretty much a family-owned and a family-run capitalism.
So whether it's old money or new money in Italy, if you've got the right name and pedigree, you're pretty much set. Is this study generating any buzz and maybe some resentment?
You know, no resentment whatsoever.
Really?
Because people think, well, too bad my family isn't prominent and I should join a prominent family. It's the other way around. There isn't that kind of resentment. The social resentment is aimed at the politicians.
What would it take for these families in Florence to lose their wealth?
You know, the problem is not for them to lose their wealth. The problem is how people that are not wealthy can acquire their wealth. Mm. But the problem is that they cannot do it because investors do not give money to people that are outside the system. I opened up a startup last year in Italy, and it's a nightmare to have a startup because you need so many connections, so many capital, so many links that a lot of people usually simply quit. So the system is geared to protect the insiders and to discourage the outsiders.
Who's the best known person in Italy with new wealth?
I would say Silvio Berlusconi. His father was a bank clerk and he became one of the richest men in the world with media and real estate and insurances and financial companies. But also, for example, Della Valle of Thoughts that created an enormous amount of wealth.
So do you think part of Silvio Berlusconi's popularity, if we can call it that, over the years was because he kind of was a self-made man?
Absolutely. The Italian left and the Italian, you know, progressive wing will never acknowledge that. But for Italians that were not wealthy, Berlusconi was a self-made man for sure.
Gianni, any predictions whether these richest families in Florence will be able to kind of retain their wealth over the next century?
I don't wish them ill at all. And I wish that they can stay warm and cozy. I hope for a new generation of Italians to be richer than they are now. And I don't see that coming because I see the country as a whole declining. And in this decline, of course, the top ruling class will hold on to their power. They will not share it.
Gianni Riotta with La Stampa. Thank you very much, Gianni.
Thank you very much.
Speaking of wealth, Rio is rushing to complete construction on what will be the largest ever Olympic village. And after the Games, the athletes' village is supposed to become luxury condos. A lot of people are upset about that, including the 4,000 families evicted from the area. Other cities have turned their Olympic villages into low-income housing. That's not exactly what's happened to Vancouver's former Olympic village. In recent months, it's become home to a couple of, oh, let's just call them local celebrities. Here's the world's Andrea Crossan.
If you wait until the sun sets, when the dog park empties out and the path clears of cyclists, you might spot them, even hear them. On this evening, they cautiously peek out of their entrance. The coast is clear, so they head out for dinner. Dinner will be the usual, tree bark. That's because the two new residents of Vancouver's 2010 Olympic Village are beavers. They've settled into a lodge that they've built here, in a pond surrounded by high-rise apartments. Biologist Nick Page is the city's beaver guy.
So we're looking at what's really a classic beaver lodge. It's this mound of vegetation, sticks, mud that the beavers have dragged in from the wetland around it to build up this lodge, to basically build a home for themselves.
So Paige keeps an eye on what the beavers are up to, and more importantly, what they're munching on. Beavers eat the bark off of trees, so he and his team have wrapped chicken wire around some of them.
We're wrapping the prominent trees. So we're basically trying to figure out a balance between tolerating what can be eaten by the beavers, but protect the larger trees. And we do that by wrapping them with wire mesh around the base, because the beavers just can't physically eat them then.
There are still trees that have clearly been gnawed on, and if anyone else had vandalized them, they'd have ended up in jail. But these beavers are riding a wave of popularity. They have a Twitter account, obviously, and Paige gets calls all the time from residents concerned that the beavers are okay and have enough food. And the city isn't planning to move them to a more rural spot.
So in the past, we would look at relocation. So you would live trap the beavers and then move them into another habitat, a more natural habitat outside the city. And those options are no longer available to us. Because of this large population throughout the region, there's no habitat that's available to kind of relocate them to.
That hasn't always been the case. There was a time when the beaver population was being decimated.
There was a big hat craze.
Frances Backhouse, author of Once They Were Hats, In Search of the Mighty Beaver. She says that European trappers capitalized on that beaver hat craze.
They were being wiped out everywhere. They just completely disappeared from most of the states, from southern Canada. And the estimate is that they were down to about 100,000 at their lowest point around 1900. So less than 1% of the original population after 300 years of trapping.
Luckily for the beavers, those hats went out of fashion. Beavers are still trapped today, but in much smaller numbers. They're trapped for their pelts and a few other uses.
Well, there's castoreum. So it's from a gland, the castor gland, which is in the nether regions of the beaver. It's used in perfume mostly. And yes, in rare cases as a food additive. And there's some kind of a schnapps from Scandinavia that is flavored with castoreum as well.
Scandinavian beaver gland schnapps. Wow. Here in Canada, the beaver has become an iconic symbol.
Our first postage stamp had a beaver on it. The nickel has a beaver on it. We just think of ourselves as the Beaver Nation.
On this night, the beavers in Vancouver's Olympic Village are enjoying a swim around their circular pond. They gnaw branches off of the trees and drag them onto the top of their lodge. Like any young urban couple, they're nesting. Nick Page says that he expects there will be beaver kits born here soon. For The World, Andrea Crossan, Vancouver.
Andrea has some great photos online of these urban beavers. Plus, you can see a contraption called a beaver deceiver, which stops beavers from damming drainage pipes. Just head over to PRI.org. News headlines are next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. An Armenian-American journalist seeks out a street in Berlin, a place with a lot of history.
It looks like any other street in Berlin, to be honest with you. It doesn't look any different. You would have to have prior knowledge of what went on there to kind of figure out where it happened.
We'll tell you what did happen on that street, coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It seems like all eyes are on the elections here, especially with the California primary just days away. But we're going to take a look first at Peru, which elects a new president on Sunday. One of the candidates has a familiar name. It's 41-year-old Keiko Fujimori. Her father is former president Alberto Fujimori, and he's in prison for crimes against humanity and corruption. The other candidate is 77-year-old Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, an economist whose mascot is a guinea pig. There's a reason for that. We'll get to that in a moment. Our own Maria Muriel is Peruvian and just returned from Peru. She spoke with a lot of Peruvians about the election, including her own extended family. So, Maria, how does Keiko Fujimori, whose father's in prison, how does she get any support at all?
Well, what you have to remember about Alberto Fujimori's presidency is that, although, yes, he did commit all these crimes against humanity, there are a lot of people who kind of uphold him in their memory as the eradicator of terrorism in Peru. He put the Shining Path guerrillas down throughout the country. He improved the economy during his terms in office. And there's a lot of people who still remember him for that rather than his scandals and going out of office.
So her opponent, Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, is an economist. Who is he? And to that question, why does he have a guinea pig as a mascot?
So the guinea pig is a really big part of Peruvian culture. You find guinea pig imagery all over souvenir shops all throughout Peru. Guinea pigs are eaten as a delicacy throughout the country, and they're just like a very beloved animal. People don't really have them as pets, but yeah, they're a really big deal to Peruvians. And the fact that he chose the guinea pig as his mascot sort of shows that he's trying to tell people, I am Peruvian, I am like everybody here. And, you know, he is sort of thought of as somebody who's more Americanized than Peruvians would maybe like their president to be.
Yeah, so he's got to make that effort. I really am one of you. I eat guinea pig.
Exactly.
You spoke with a number of Peruvians, Maria. Did you get a sense of who's supporting whom there?
Well, I spent a week in Cusco, and mostly everybody I spoke to there is against Fujimori, because Fujimori Sr., while he was in office, hit that area the hardest, Cusco and the surrounding provinces, because that's sort of where the guerrilla groups were bred out of. And also, his policy toward eradicating poverty was to sterilize indigenous people, or it was presented as such. So a lot of that is remembered by the people who
bad
live there
now. Bad legacy there in Cusco.
Yeah. And so a lot of people in Cusco support Kuczynski. And I actually spoke to a 17-year-old activist who he said he was trying to educate people on why they should vote against Fujimori. And he's saying he's part of a group whose main objective is to inform people of the crimes that Alberto Fujimori committed and to vote against Keiko, because a vote for her would be a vote to continue his dictatorship. You know, there's a lot of this feeling in Cusco. I mean, every cab that I got into, people asked me who I was voting for, and they said they were voting for Kuczynski. However, I also walked into a presidential rally just in the middle of the street in Cusco where there were a lot of Fujimori supporters, including an indigenous woman who says she's poor and she thinks Keiko Fujimori is going to help her get her kids an education. So she's saying Keiko will help my children get an education. Sometimes there's only a chance for rich people to send their kids to school, and Keiko will change that for me. And this is a woman of indigenous descent. You know, she was out there wearing her traditional garb, and she was staunchly supporting Keiko Fujimori. So it's kind of all over the place.
I mean, it's interesting because Peru's outgoing president, Ollanta Humala, leaned on his indigenous roots during his campaign. So how exactly does identity figure into this election?
Yeah, that is an interesting piece of this election, because now people are referring to the candidates as La China, that's Keiko Fujimori, and El Gringo, that's Kuczynski.
Right.
Yeah, La China, because she's of Asian descent. And actually, my grandmother was actually talking to me about this, too. You know, she was like, it's funny that now we have these two candidates who are La China and El Gringo. They're sort of different ethnicities, and they're not the majority, which in Peru is of indigenous ethnic groups are the majority.
I know Peru has mandatory voting, so everybody who can vote must vote. Does that make Election Day especially exciting? And what about this one coming up this Sunday?
Everybody's talking about it. Everywhere I went, everybody asked me who I was voting for, and they're very straightforward about that. There are some people who, because voting is mandatory, some people will mark, like, off the grid, you know? So instead of choosing a candidate, they'll just, like, write something, maybe even, like, a doodle or, like, a
somewhere
screw
on the ballot.
You to the government, somewhere on the ballot. Yeah, and actually, some of my family members were even talking about that they're going to do that. And I think that's interesting because if they don't vote, they get a fine.
How much could you be fined?
It could be up to 200 soles around there. And that's about 60, 70 bucks.
The World's Maria Muriel, just back from Peru. Thanks very much, Maria.
Thank you, Marco.
We've got Maria's photos, including a guy in a guinea pig suit at the presidential rally in Cusco. You got to see them. They're at PRI.org. The U.S. hasn't done it yet, but Germany has. Yesterday, the German parliament voted nearly unanimously to recognize the Armenian Genocide. That's the massacre of more than 1 million Armenians at the hands of Ottoman Turks during World War I. Turkey disputes the number and still refuses to call it a genocide, and wasn't too pleased with Germany's declaration. For Armenian-American journalist Liana Agajanian, this was huge news, and it made her think about one particular street in Berlin, the street where Talat Pasha, Turkish mastermind behind the Armenian Genocide, was assassinated. You tweeted this week, Liana, about visiting this street in Berlin, recalling it as, quote, tangible when so many things for Armenian communities have not been. Explain what you mean by that.
Armenians are kind of spread across in every part of the world, and we've rebuilt our lives several times, and we've either been forced out or left tangible physical spaces for a very long time. And being there just connected me to a part of our history that a lot of us don't have access to.
What does the street look like today?
It looks like any other street in Berlin, to be honest with you. It doesn't look any different. It's in an affluent suburb of Berlin, pretty big street. If you weren't looking for this particular event, you would never have known. There's no markers. There's absolutely nothing.
Tell us who Talat Pasha was.
Talat Pasha was a high-ranking official in the Ottoman Empire, and he was the Minister of the Interior at the time. He actually ordered the arrest and deportation of Armenian intellectuals in Constantinople, and eventually his events led to the initiation of the genocide. And so he, along with a few other people, are seen as the main orchestrators of the entire massacres that began on April 24th, 1915.
And what was he doing in Berlin?
He had actually escaped. He had fled to Berlin. He was actually found guilty of the massacres and sentenced to death by the Turkish court in 1919.
So the Turkish court sentenced him to death. I mean, does that suggest that there are people in Turkey who really oppose what happened back in World War One?
Yes, definitely. There are many people, and still are a growing number of people, who were looking on that side of history and opposing what was going on. I believe their voices have been quite lost in all of this debate. And I think that we're now at a time when we can begin telling those stories too.
And Germany itself, did it have a role in the Armenian genocide?
They had an indirect role in the genocide. Germany was an ally of the Ottoman Empire during the war and had officials stationed across the empire. And so these officials witnessed massacres and they reported their events to each other. And there is evidence of that, but no attempts were made to exert influence on Turkey or stop what was going on. And so their role was quite indirect.
The German resolution that passed yesterday recognizing the Armenian genocide was spearheaded by a German MP with Turkish roots, a man named Kem Özdemir. And he said something really powerful in front of the parliament. He said, "Working through the Shoah is a basis of democracy in Germany," referring to the Holocaust, the Shoah there. "This genocide," he continued, "is also waiting to be worked through." Tell us why it's important that Germany officially recognize the 1915 massacre as a genocide.
It's important because Germany is a major country with a lot of influence, and them recognizing it could lead to some kind of effect where other countries recognize it. And I think more significant for me in terms of recognition was the person who championed all of this. Mr. Özdemir comes from a Turkish Circassian background, and that to me is much more meaningful than a government recognition of the event.
Why is that important, that particular background?
Because I think that the most meaningful change that can come of all of this has to come from within Turkey and within people who are of Turkish descent. In order for things to move forward and for reconciliation to happen, I think looking back at one's own history and acknowledging those blind spots in history are going to be the cornerstones which lead to reconciliation and communication.
Liana, I'd love to know what compelled you to visit this street.
When you're growing up as an Armenian, you hear a lot of stories, and this particular event that happened in Berlin was one of the stories that I heard growing up. And so it just felt natural for me to go there. A lot of Armenians don't know about their own history. And so it was just a small part of my bigger pull to discover all of that.
Armenian-American journalist Liana Agajanian, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Ego sum, Marco Werman, et hoc est mundo. No, we're not just switching to Latin for the fun of it. I'm getting in the mood for this next story, which is all about Roman London, or Londinium, and the discovery of hundreds of documents that have survived nearly 2,000 years back to the city's very beginnings. The world's one-man history desk, Chris Wolf, has been rummaging through. Chris, tell us what you found.
I love this stuff, man. This is my hometown, and this is so cool. This is, you know, for the first time, we have some of the words and thoughts of the very first Londoners. For example, there's an IOU from a freed slave, a guy called Tibulus, dated precisely to January the 8th, 57 AD
wow.
in the Roman calendar. Now, Tibullus was some kind of businessman, and he's recording the fact that he owes 105 denarii, which is like the basic coin, like dollars, to another freedman called Gratus from the profits of merchandise that they've sold and delivered. And this little IOU is already officially the oldest handwritten document ever found in Britain.
Well, handwritten documents, what were they actually written on?
So this is where it gets really cool, because the Romans had paper, but paper's very expensive. Mm. So just for taking notes, you know, for bills and IOUs and legal briefs and letters, you know, to loved ones or whoever, the Romans used these thin wooden tablets covered with beeswax, and you simply etch your words in the wax with a stylus. They're reusable, since you just melt the wax and start over, giving you a clean slate, literally a tabula rasa,
right.
is what they would call it. And the leading archaeologist on the project says, this is like the email of the Roman world.
That's incredible. So the beeswax survived 2,000 years?
No, the wood survived, astonishingly. And that's one of the amazing things. Basically, it looks like, from the location, the theory is that this was in the trash, and the trash was used to shore up the banks of this little creek that runs through London. And they sank in the mud. And the thickness and density of the mud did one of those miraculous things where it prevented oxygen from the air getting to them, which would have made them rot. So what's happened is either the writer would have etched through the wax and into the wood itself,
gotcha.
Or somehow it there's leaves some kind of chemical mark on the wood below, which they can then use all kinds of high-tech stuff to actually recover words from what might look like blank pieces of wood.
What do we learn actually about London 2,000 years ago?
Well, one news agency, I have to give credit for this quote, they said, AFP, they came, they saw, they got down to business.
That's pretty good.
It's because London was founded as a fort, vital to protect the bridge over the biggest river in the south of England. And there are hundreds of these little forts and bridges and things all over England. But what we're learning from these documents is that London very quickly became very different. And this looks like the whole city kind of bloomed in the aftermath of the invasion thanks to free enterprise. What happens is that the site is navigable to the biggest ships of the era, so it becomes like very quickly a big trading port.
Right.
And so very quickly this population grows of a cosmopolitan bunch of enterprising businessmen from all over the Roman Empire, traders, sailors, dock workers, craftsmen. And so London's quickly transformed from rolling countryside to the biggest city north of the Alps. Although that's all relative, that's about 60,000 people was the peak population. It's about the size of Schenectady, New York today, or Encinitas in California.
That.
Or it's about how many people can sit down at Gillette Stadium to watch a Pats game.
Do you consider these Romans the founding fathers of London?
Absolutely. I mean, like, it became the commercial, industrial, legal hub of southern England very quickly. And, you know, the fort was there obviously first, but these people created kind of the life and soul of London that survives.
Where does the word Londinium come from?
Well, this is one of the things that they're discovering, is that it actually was called London or Londinium, because one of the tablets they found is actually addressed to Mogontius in London. And that's dated from about 65 to 80 AD, a full half a century earlier than the next oldest reference that have survived in the historical record. And Mogontius, incidentally, is the Romanized version of a Celtic name. So it just gives you an insight into some of the globalization that's taking place in the early Roman Empire.
Any other highlights from this discovery, Chris?
Well, one other thing is a very simple one. It's just what could be the first example of learning in what's now the UK. It's somebody simply practicing their alphabet. Obviously, they're learning to write, which is fascinating. And that's what I really like about all this discovery, is that you're seeing the lives of the very ordinary people, the small traders, the judges, soldiers, well, you know, relatively ordinary people. The Romans are very good at carefully recording their history, their laws, their literature, but they didn't really care about much else. So it's this kind of breakthrough that's helping us put together the pieces. And one of the lead translator actually on the project said, it's been a privilege to eavesdrop on the on the people of Roman London.
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolf, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. A lot of people here in the U.S. are frustrated by the choices in this presidential election year. One complaint is how entrenched the political parties are. That's been true in Mexico, too, but there's a major shift beginning to happen. Mexico holds midterm elections this weekend, and there's a new crop of independent candidates starting to shake things up, tapping into public frustration with politics as usual. The World's Monica Campbell recently met the first independent candidate in Mexico to win a seat in Congress.
My name is Pedro Kumamoto. I'm 26 years old. I'm from Guadalajara.
Pedro Kumamoto, young, wearing jeans, an untucked shirt, not your typical Mexican politician. Picture him at a cafe with friends or jogging around the park, rather than some upscale power lunch chauffeured in an SUV with tinted windows, the usual image of politicians here.
Almost everyone is white, lawyer, 50 years old, high class.
There's also his last name, Kumamoto. His great-grandfather was from Japan and left there by ship. He thought he was landing in California, but somehow ended up in Chiapas and married a Mayan woman. So Kumamoto has indigenous roots.
I'm brown.
Last year, Kumamoto made international headlines. Mexico's first independent politician to win a federal seat in Congress, representing a district in the second largest city, Guadalajara.
When we started, they told me, you won't win. You won't be able to defeat those political parties who have a lot of money and a lot of people supporting them. And we won.
He broke the mold, defeating candidates from entrenched parties, raising $14,000 from small donations from people fed up with politics as usual. That frustration let him beat a political machine
that tries to stop every political effort that is not about money or their friends.
Now, Kumamoto and people like him are slowly gaining ground. And it was only last year that the law changed to let independents run. One Indy candidate also won a governorship. And ahead of Mexico's midterm elections this weekend, independents are running in a dozen states. One question is, why did traditional parties here, with a tight grip on politics, risk changing the law and losing any power to independent candidates? I asked Viridiana Rios, a political analyst in Mexico City and a fellow with DC's Woodrow Wilson Center.
They didn't have an option. The amount of pressure that happened from civil society and from many groups was just overwhelming. Certainly, they didn't think independent candidates would get that far. They were surprised. They were absolutely surprised.
But right now, there's only so much change someone like Kumamoto can make, since he lacks traditional party leverage. He knows this, but says he offers something different.
I ask to my constituency to make pressure to all these congressmen and women about what we are doing. I ask them to tweet them, to phone them. My biggest strength is not about what I can do inside the local Congress. It's what I do outside.
So far, he sponsored a law that made his state a sanctuary for migrants passing through Mexico. And now he's pushing to strip legislators of their immunity from prosecution, a long tradition here. He thinks more people like him are on the way, part of a new political generation. We met during a meeting of a group Kumamoto belongs to called Wiki Politica. It's a small but growing network run by civically engaged young people demanding more from government. Alejandro Soto is a political science student and part of the network. He says he's determined to fight corruption in Mexico and taps that anger toward trying to make change through the electoral process, not just through street protests. Anger is also what drove Kumamoto into politics.
It started since I was a teenager, really into the social movements all over Mexico.
He protested police brutality in Mexico City. And in Guadalajara, he tried to block new freeways, insisting on public transportation instead. He lost that battle and expects more defeats.
And I like to think myself as a loser in many things. But I always like to say that sometimes you need to learn how to lose in order to learn how to win.
But there is worry here about independent candidates. Again, Viridiana Rios.
We have no certainty as to whether an independent candidate is going to be better than a party candidate or not. Actually, independent candidates may be more dangerous than party candidates. Because with parties, at least the party is there after the person is left. So there is some form of, you know, punishment that the electorate can give them. However, an independent person is just himself. After he's done, he's done. Many authoritarian regimes in Latin America have emerged from supposedly independent candidates.
Kumamoto says he actually does believe in political parties.
The big problem here in Mexico is that we don't have political parties. We have companies. They are business. They are not thinking how to be more representative of the people. They're trying to get money, get power, and that's it.
But until he sees a real change in how the party machines here work, he says he'll stay away from them and keep going his own way. For The World, Monica Campbell, Guadalajara, Mexico.
Finally today, a quick look ahead to a story we'll have for you next week. In the 1920s, a British ethnomusicologist named Hugh Tracy went to Africa. He visited more than a dozen countries and brought back sounds like this. Over the next 50 years, Tracy collected some 35,000 recordings of traditional African music. That archive has been opened up, and some London musicians and DJs have decided to give the tracks new life. The project's called Beating Heart. A musician named Nabiha Iqbal remixed that track, which features the Mbira, a traditional African thumb piano.
So I took a sample of that, a loop, and I worked for quite a while with it, trying out different ideas, and nothing really stuck with me, and then I just deleted everything and started again. And then I decided to kind of stick with that motif of the Mbira sound running through and build it up, but using my own sound palette that was like an electronic reflection of the raw field recording sound, and build it up that way.
Listen up for more from Nabiha and more about the Beating Heart Project next week on The World. Our own theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.